Want instant MVP status? Join the new Dick's Scorecard Plus program. For $99, Scorecard Plus members enjoy 1 year packed with perks, like $80 in annual bonus rewards, free shipping with no minimum purchase, triple points on 2 purchases, and more. That's over $160 in benefits. Join Dick's Scorecard Plus today and score more than ever. Tap the banner to learn more. Exclusions and terms apply. Visit dicks.com/scorecardplus for details.
Welcome back to On the Case, the podcast. I'm Paula Zahn, and thanks for joining us for Pod 24, Justice Frozen. Tonight, we're on the case in Garfield County, Utah. It was here in an area best known for the beauty of Bryce Canyon that an ugly murder mystery slowly unfolded. From the moment investigators discovered the victim, it became clear they were on the hunt for a cold and calculating killer, one that for years appeared to be too cunning to be caught.
April 20th, 1998. It was a cold, crisp spring Monday afternoon in the rugged terrain over Lake Powell, when a couple driving to do some sightseeing noticed something unusual.
Agent Brian Davis.
Husband and wife are driving, and off to their right, they observe an object laying off the road. It looks suspicious to them. And they stop and quickly realize that they need to call police.
The couple said that along their travels, they made a disturbing discovery. They described in detail what they had found.
It was a sleeping bag that was wrapped with duct tape and tied with rope on the outside. It appeared that there was a body that was in that sleeping bag.
Police raced to the scene. When they arrived, they saw for themselves what the couple had reported. Almost immediately, they confirmed the couple's fear.
They pretty quickly identify what they have as a human body. They set up a crime scene, they coordinate with the crime lab, and from there they begin their investigation of an apparent homicide.
The desolate area where the body had been found led investigators to believe that the killer wasn't expecting anyone to stumble upon it until he was long gone.
Agent John Kaiser.
This is a very remote area of the state of Utah, on the south end of the Henry Mountains at maybe 6,000 feet elevation.
As detectives searched the location in the vicinity of the body, they uncovered a potential clue.
There were some faint tire tracks that could have been from the vehicle. They did document those tracks and even took some tire impressions.
But there were no other clues in the area. Police could only hope that the medical examiner would find more evidence when he looked inside the sleeping bag. Even that analysis wouldn't be easy. The body had been meticulously wrapped and tied with a variety of materials.
It was unusual in the detail and the complexity of it. Bound with black plastic and then duct taped and then tied and put in a sleeping bag. There was carpet that you would put in a children's room to play on. What an odd selection to wrap her up in.
They were able to remove all of the packaging, the rope, the duct tape, plastic.
Investigators were stunned when they peeled back all the odd layers and discovered that the victim herself had been tied up as well.
Ankles, wrists were bound with duct tape and with rope. and her wrists were also bound down at her sides. Her head was covered with a black plastic bag and then wrapped tightly with gray duct tape.
Sergeant Ryan Van Fleet.
The knots were pretty elaborate knots. They looked like they were made by someone who knew how to make specific knots.
Once all the materials were photographed and removed, it appeared that the victim was a woman between 35 and 45 years old. The report noted that she was likely of Hispanic or Native American descent, but there was no way to be sure. Further examination of the body only deepened the mystery.
She was frozen completely.
Police were stunned.
I was shocked by the lengths the person went to wrap up and to freeze the victim.
But the killer's actions provided them a few critical clues. It was clear that their suspect had gone to extreme lengths in order to transport his victim and dump her in the secluded location. But by freezing her, he unintentionally helped investigators develop a timeline for the crime.
In April, near the area of Lake Powell, it's warming up. I mean, winter's passed. The body would not be frozen to the core from the elements. It would have had to been frozen likely in a commercial freezer or some type of a deep freeze. So based on the fact that the body was still frozen to the core, that would indicate the body wasn't there very long to still be frozen.
The medical examiner also took note of how the woman was dressed.
The only clothing she had on was a bra and panties. It was a white cotton cloth, and it had pictures of oranges and apples.
Still, there was no evidence the victim had been sexually assaulted.
Other than the body and the way it was packaged and wrapped, there was no other evidence to collect.
The victim had no defensive wounds, and making a determination of how she died required a closer look at her body. During the autopsy, the medical examiner discovered that the victim had died from a gunshot wound.
The bullet to the back of the skull, and the bullet entered at the base of the skull, causing massive damage to the brain without causing a mess or exiting the skull.
It was from a small caliber firearm. There were only fragments that were recovered, not enough to necessarily determine a caliber.
The single gunshot had been fired at close range. The chilling details helped investigators create a theory of how the crime had unfolded.
It would have likely happened by surprise to her. She was not bound or physically restrained when she was killed.
And the final cruelty noted in the report was perhaps the most gruesome.
Her fingertips had all been removed.
It was a detail that sickened detectives.
It's very disturbing to look at this victim, to look at another human being being treated that way after she'd been killed.
Whoever committed the crime had put a lot of time and effort into covering their tracks.
A lot of times even travel would necessitate fingerprints being taken. So it's likely that someone would have fingerprints on file somewhere. And by removing those fingertips, we had no idea who this woman was. And we really had very little to go on as far as how we were going to find out.
It was clear that the killer did not want the victim to be identified.
There were just a lot of things that were done to separate the suspect from the victim.
Investigators theorized that this was no random act of violence. It appeared to be a premeditated murder.
They spent a lot of time with that body. This was not a random act.
and they were convinced that the crime was personal.
I think we were looking for someone who knew her well. There was obviously a lot of planning that went into that.
Investigators wondered if that plan might ultimately backfire. They hoped one of the killer's cold-blooded steps to hide the murder might actually connect him to it.
In order to shoot a person like that, there'd have to be a place to do it. To take someone's fingertips, you'd have to have the tools there available to do it. However she was frozen, that's not something that I think everyone has access to.
The body was frozen, presumably in a deep freeze, large enough for the body to be laying horizontal. To freeze that way would indicate some type of a large commercial freezer and or some type of a refrigerated unit, a reefer unit in a truck that the body could have been transported in as well.
Investigators began building a profile of the suspect they were looking for.
What kind of person could do something like that? You think of like a sociopath or a psychopath or someone who just lacks conscience, whose only really cares what benefits themselves without regarding how anyone else feels. It doesn't matter to them. So at this point, of course, we didn't have a motive of why this occurred, but we knew what had occurred, and certainly it's pretty telling what kind of person this was that could do this with really a lack of regard and respect for human life, for another human being.
Not only was the killer dangerous, those on the case believed he had likely killed before.
He was experienced. Perhaps he had done it before.
Before they could begin searching for who was responsible for the horrible crime, they needed to identify the victim. But the lack of evidence complicated their investigation.
There was absolutely zero identification. The perpetrator had taken great care, ensuring that the body would be very difficult to identify.
But those actions were in stark contrast with how little effort he put into hiding the body.
It was very apparent that the perpetrator wanted that person to be found, but not identified. Why was that? It was a big mystery.
Detectives hope the testing of the elaborate set of bindings removed from the victim's body might put them on the trail of a suspect.
The Utah State Crime Lab was given those items to process. There ultimately was no DNA or hair fibers found, but they did obtain a partial palm print.
The partial palm print gave detectives physical evidence from the crime scene that they could compare to a suspect. But there was a major hurdle. Palm prints were rarely collected during arrests.
There's not a whole lot of times where people would have full palm print taken. We could do all the testing we want on palms. It's unlikely you're going to be able to match them.
Even more daunting, investigators had nothing pointing them in the direction of a suspect. Detectives felt they were searching for a needle in a haystack. Officers patrolled the area where the body was discovered.
One of the things that they did is they kind of did a canvas of the area for witnesses that were along that stretch of highway and some of the neighboring towns in and around the Lake Powell area, campgrounds, resort areas, to see if anyone had seen or observed or noticed anything.
But no witness was found. And that was just one of the many obstacles investigators had to overcome. But the victim had one distinctive trait that could potentially help them identify her.
There were no tattoos or other distinguishable marks on her body. The only one of note was she had a mole in her upper right earlobe, which is a pretty unique mark.
Police turned to the media for help.
They had a flyer that went out to media outlets with sketches of this victim in an effort to get help from the public.
They actually went on a local news station and did a program where they talked about the crime and the victim and asked for tips. There were some tips, I guess, that came in after their broadcast, but nothing that panned out with anything.
Investigators quickly widened their search. Since she had been frozen for transport, it was likely she wasn't from the area.
I think that was probably the general feeling. In that part of Utah, there are a lot of people that are traveling from other states. They put her information in the NAMIS, a national database for missing and unidentified people.
But police weren't able to match their Jane Doe to any missing persons report in the NAMIS system. Within 72 hours, police already feared the investigation was stalling. Then, a deputy from a neighboring county reached out with an important tip.
3 days after the body was found, this individual named Eric Brocks was arrested for DUI, just north of where the body was found.
Eric Brocks was driving recklessly and appeared to be impaired.
During this arrest, Eric Brocks made a statement regarding his wife. He made a comment that his wife was finally happy where she is now. That made that deputy suspicious.
The deputy was troubled by the remark because Brocks had been alone when he was arrested. And the way he had said she was finally happy led him to consider if what Brocks actually meant was that his wife was dead.
Brocks made quite a few statements about having dropped off his wife a couple of hours before he was arrested.
Those words now seemed like they might have a double meaning. Brocks raised more red flags when he said his wife was 5'2 and a Native American.
The Wayne County deputy contacted the Garfield County sheriff and said, "I think this is someone you need to look at."
On the Case, the podcast will continue in a moment. It's time to do that spring reset in your closet. As winter starts to back off, we all want to refresh our wardrobe with pieces that are well-made and versatile. And that makes Quince the place to shop for these new additions. Quince makes beautiful everyday clothing using premium materials like 100% European linen, organic cotton, and super soft denim with styles starting around $50. Their spring pieces are lightweight, breathable, and effortless. And that same focus on materials carries over into their accessories, like their leather bags that look and feel way more expensive than they are. My cashmere sweaters have been amazing. They work pretty much with anything I wear them with. I can't wait to go to quince.com to pick up a few new shirts for the warmer weather. The styles are fun, and the prices can't be beat. Refresh your spring wardrobe with Quince. Go to quince.com/OTCpod for free shipping and 365-day returns. Now available in Canada, too. Go to quince.com/OTCpod for free shipping and 365-day returns. quince.com/OTCpod. ...42-year-old Eric Brocks instantly became a suspect. Police tried to get more information out of him about his wife. Agent Brian Davis.
He gave a name and a date of birth for his wife, And the investigators did what they could to find her.
The effort led nowhere. Sergeant Ryan Van Fleet.
The fact that we couldn't locate a wife or evidence of a wife was pretty concerning and suspicious.
There was no match to the name in any public database. But a search of their suspect's impounded car sharpened the investigator's theory.
There were things that were just incredibly suspicious. There were women's hairs located on the seats of the vehicle. There was perfume in the glove box.
Investigators spoke with several witnesses who had seen Brox during his time in Utah, but they weren't able to confirm the story he had told police.
No one could recall that he was with a woman ever.
As investigators continued to question him, they began to wonder if Brox's story about having a wife was a complete fabrication.
They never could verify really anything of what he'd said. Was she even a real person?
As I looked at the totality of the things he said, a lot of things seemed to almost be made up on the fly.
Why Brox lied about his missing wife was a mystery. And while his words and actions had placed them on the radar, police couldn't come up with anything that tied Brox to the victim.
They asked for a full palm print from Eric Brox, but they were never able to make a match with the palm print found.
Without physical evidence linking him to the crime scene, police were forced to move on. Shockingly, investigators got some stunning information.
I was contacted through the Garfield County Sheriff's Office to let me know that Eric Brox had been arrested for murdering his mother in Nebraska. And so once we knew that, that brought the whole thing up again, thinking that maybe there was something we'd missed, overlooked the first time, and that maybe Eric Brox was again a viable possibility.
Agent Ryan Van Fleet had investigators in Nebraska speak with Brox's family to see if they had any information connecting him to the murder of the Jane Doe victim in Utah.
The things that came out of it were that Brox owned a tree trimming business, and the kind of rope that was found on the victim would have been consistent with the kind of rope that they'd used in that business.
In fact, one family member identified the rope used in the crime as belonging to Brox. But when police tried to tie him to the unidentified victim, they hit another dead end.
None of his family had any idea who the victim was or had any idea what he might have been doing out here, and so there was not very much to go on after that.
Ultimately, nothing ever tied him to that victim in any way. They didn't have enough to charge him with anything.
Eric Brox was officially cleared, and investigators were back to square one. At least until the FBI reached out with a promising new lead. They were investigating a man named Scott Kimball. Based on his violent past, they thought he could have been responsible for Jane Doe's death.
In 2011, FBI agent Johnny Grusing contacted the Utah State Bureau of Investigation about a possible connection from Scott to our victim.
Agent Grusing told detectives that Kimball had been leading a double life. Special Agent Jonathan Grusing.
Scott Kimball was an informant for the Denver FBI, but the FBI was unaware that at the time he was an informant, he was going around killing people.
In fact, The former FBI informant was a serial killer already convicted of 4 murders. And a suspect in more than 20 other unsolved crimes.
A lot of people went missing when they were around Scott Kimball.
He's smart, he's manipulative, he's a sociopath.
But even more critical for the Utah Jane Doe investigators, Kimball routinely drove a truck on the stretch of highway where the unidentified woman had been found. And he had routinely been in that area around the time of the murder.
He would run a route from Montana down to California, up to Spokane, and back to Montana. So he was through Utah a lot.
And his line of work made transporting a frozen body long distances easy.
He was hauling beef from Colorado to California.
His refrigerated truck set off alarm bells. Police carefully studied Kimball's 4 murders. His MO in those attacks varied widely, but several seemed linked to the murder in Utah.
Most of his victims were females. Gunshot wound to the back of the head. No DNA at the crime scene. Wrapped in multiple layers. Fingers severed. Body disposal just being dumped.
All of those details appeared to tie Kimball to the Jane Doe murder as well.
One thing that really stuck out to us was the series of complex and unique knots that the victim was bound with. And specifically compared to one of Scott Kimball's victims, he was also bound with very similar looking knots.
Investigators believe it led to one conclusion.
They look like they were tied by the same person.
To the naked eye, any normal person could look at those knots and go, those are very similar. And it was certainly something we had to consider, that Scott Kimball tied both of those knots. And with everything else we knew of Scott Kimball circumstantially, and later on even by some of his own admissions, they were things that were important to us in our investigation.
Given all the connections to the case, Special Agent Grusing decided to ask Scott Kimball about the murder.
I would bring up this Jane Doe, because he would say, well, what else do you have, Grusing? I'd say, well, I've got this one from Montana. I've got this Jane Doe from Utah, and speak about a few others. And when we would discuss Jane Doe, he would say, well, tell me about her. I'd say, well, the knots that were around your victim, Scott, they're almost identical to these knots.
The serial killer neither confirmed nor denied his involvement.
He said, you go do your research, Johnny. This is just a puzzle, and you have to figure it out. It was like he was leaving breadcrumbs.
The ever-growing trail of clues Kimball gave investigators led them to believe that the man responsible for the Utah Jane Doe murder might be ready to confess.
He goes, I'll tell you right now where I killed someone, and just to prove it, you can look it up on the map while I'm talking, and the date, place, and time I'll give you will be dead on with the facts of the homicide. He would play games like a cat with a ball of yarn.
Detective Brian Davis decided it was time to pay Kimball a visit.
We went out and interviewed him in prison in Colorado. And at this point in our investigation, we had really delved into Kimball as much as we possibly could. So we wanted to attempt an interview with him. We were hoping that he would just give us something. Maybe he'd just admit to it.
But sitting down face to face with him was more difficult than he had anticipated.
It was challenging. I mean, initially, it didn't look like he was going to talk to us. He wants to be in control. He wants to be in charge.
Kimball began the interview with Detective Davis by walking back the statements he had made that implicated him in the Utah Jane Doe murder.
when you're doing that global plea agreement, looking at the list of possible homicides, and when the case of this female, you said that her name should be added to the list.
I don't remember that.
Despite Kimball's denial, investigators pressed on. They asked about the complicated knots he had tied during his previous murders.
We have knots from this victim. I've just got some pictures of him.
Just remember, everything I learned from being on a Boy Scout troop. They're not unique.
Investigators then used information provided by Scott Kimball's own son, a clue that appeared to link the serial killer to another piece of crime scene evidence.
Scott Kimball's son had the exact same playmat when he was 5 years old, and when his son was 5 years old, it was 1998.
I know that your boy, Justin, when he was 5, he had the same mat. That's another thing that's interesting.
Well, I'm sure Fisher-Price or Toys R Us sold millions of those. I mean, let's be realistic. If you're going to commit a homicide, you're going to find a tarp, you're not going to buy a Fisher-Price rug or whatever it is.
Police believe Kimball was always on the edge of a confession if there was something in it for him.
He wanted better living space. He wanted better facilities. He wanted more freedom in jail.
I deserve to be in prison. They build prisons for people just like me. I have nothing to lose by cooperating.
Exactly.
One thing I have by cooperating is it would actually be the game. I'm in the very worst spot that they have in Colorado. So maybe you guys can move me somewhere else. It's better.
I don't have the power to do that.
And once Kimball was certain investigators had nothing to give him, the cat and mouse game came to an end.
This is where I'm at with this. I tried this whole false confession thing. I tried this whole thing to get what I wanted. It didn't work. Even when I tell the truth, they don't believe me. People hate to admit they're when they're wrong.
Investigators remained skeptical that Kimball had told them everything he knew.
We thought Scott could have been responsible just because of the similarities.
But the convicted serial killer was done talking.
If you had any physical evidence on any crime, you would arrest me. You're just wasting your time.
Scott Kimball abruptly ended the interview. Despite his denials, detectives remained convinced the convicted serial killer had taken Jane Doe's life.
I still believed it was possible.
Everything kept saying we can't rule him out.
Investigators hoped that there was someone out there that might be able to tie Scott Kimball to the murder. So they turned to the public for help.
We were still considering him a suspect in this case. We had really exhausted everything that we could think of. Circumstantially, with evidence, Kimball is still a suspect in our minds. So the FBI agreed to let that become public and tie our case into it. We were hoping for tips. At that point, we had kind of done what we could do.
But no one came forward with any information about Kimball that actually tied him to the Utah Jane Doe murder. Investigators then decided to try a different approach.
We go to our local media and we release a photo of our victim, an actual photo of her after she was deceased.
And that unusual act of desperation set off an absolutely stunning chain of events that would push a stalled investigation into high gear. More on The Case, the podcast, after this. After the photo was released, investigators got the break they had been waiting decades for. It came from an amateur sleuth calling in after seeing the picture on TV. Agent Brian Davis.
A tip from a woman who actually was in California. Was looking through NamUs, doing this kind of as a hobby.
The woman told Detective Davis that while she was looking through recent updates to the National Missing Persons Database, she found a photo from a case that appeared to be a match to his Utah Jane Doe.
She sees these two photos and she thinks that's possibly the same person.
Detective Davis was intrigued.
When you look at the two photos, they do look similar.
The woman then pointed out the mole on the upper right ear of the missing person's photo.
That mole was what really led us to believe that this was the same person.
But even after the amateur sleuth's amazing find, investigators still wondered if it was possible that the details of the two cases would line up. And then she shared another incredible coincidence. Although the Ohio victim had been reported missing in 1998, law enforcement had only added her photo to NamUs just days after Utah released their picture of the Jane Doe.
Well, I guess you can call it fate or divine intervention. It was incredible.
For the first time in the investigation, police had a solid lead on their victim's name. The Ohio Missing Persons Report identified the woman as 37-year-old Lena Reyes Guedes. And she had vanished without a trace 12 days before the Jane Doe's body had been found. Investigators believe they were on the right track in trying to identify their Jane Doe.
I was pretty certain it was Lena.
But proving it wouldn't be easy. Lena's husband had died in 2001, and according to the file, the rest of her family lived in Mexico.
She had a degree in international import-export. Previously worked at a company in Mexico. She was a ballet dancer. She was the shining star of her family.
She followed her heart to spend her life with her love interest in the United States.
She had met Edward Geddes, a chemical engineer, pretty successful, and they got married in 1996. So they'd been married approximately 2 years before Lena goes missing.
The information all seemed to be pointing in the right direction, but there was only one way to be certain Lena Geddes was the Utah Jane Doe.
It was challenging. We were reaching out to the Mexican consulate for information, and ultimately what we would need to really confirm her identity would be a DNA sample from family.
The consulate attempted to contact the members of Lena's family mentioned in the missing persons report, but they weren't able to locate them. So they turned to the Mexican media for help, and their hard work paid off.
A few days later, we get a phone call from a woman in Mexico claiming to be a sister of Lena.
Her DNA was taken for testing, and the results were stunning. They confirmed that Lena was in fact the Utah Jane Doe, whose identity had been a mystery for more than 20 years.
It was amazing, to say the least. We were over the moon. We were ecstatic.
Now that Lena had been officially identified, investigators set out to solve her murder. And the reports gave police an obvious first suspect, her husband, Edward Geddes. He had told police that the last time he had seen Lena was at the airport on her way to visit family in Mexico. He said Lena planned to fly to Texas and then take a bus across the border.
He stated that he dropped her off on April 8th.
But the case file indicated that Lena never arrived in Mexico. In fact, there was no record that a plane ticket to Texas was ever purchased.
Law enforcement interviewed Edward Geddes in 1998.
Throughout the interview, Geddes was evasive, but stuck to his story that Lena had gone to visit her family.
She wanted to go down to Mexico. She was talking about being good to see her father and how happy her father is going to be.
As Investigator Davis watched Geddes' tape-recorded interrogation from 1998, every statement raised more red flags, in particular, his memories of those final hours with Lena.
She got up pretty early that morning and put on a pair of underpants and a bra. The reason I remember it is it was my favorite pants and bra. It was white cotton with pictures of apples and maybe bananas on it.
Investigators believed that his disturbingly detailed description of what Lena had been wearing was critical.
He describes perfectly the underwear that she was wearing in Utah when she was found dead.
Edward Geddes couldn't remember anything else Lena was wearing, but he did remember something that further linked him to the crime scene evidence.
She had a sleeping bag, which was going to be a present for one of her little cousins. Now, I had rolled it some bitch up tight.
This navy blue sleeping bag matched the description of the sleeping bag that she was found in.
Investigators were confident they were getting closer to solving the mystery. And interviews with the couple's friends pointed to a potential motive. The couple had been having a lot of marital issues.
Lena was not happy with the marriage. She had confided in people that he was controlling and abusive, manipulative. She wanted to leave him.
Loved ones also mentioned that Edward Geddes had mysteriously vanished not long after Lena went missing.
According to his brother, Edward was driving to Texas to look for Lena.
But there were no records that placed Geddes in Texas. But it turned out that he was gone for 4 days.
That would have been his time to drive from Ohio to Utah to discard that body.
And there was more. As the owner of a chemical plant, Geddes had access to commercial freezers, as well as vans and trucks large enough to transport a body. Despite all the circumstantial clues, Investigator Davis still needed additional evidence, and forensic analyst Kathy McKay had an idea of how they could get it.
Part of my position is to learn about new DNA tools and techniques and pass that information on.
Analyst McKay was focused on the carefully knotted rope found on Lena's body.
That rope had been tested 2 or 3 times by conventional standards with no results. Kathy came to me and suggested a method called the MVAC.
It was a new technology used for DNA collection.
It's this commercial type looking vacuum. It catches DNA particles. And from there, they take the filters and send it to the lab to be tested.
McKay went through the evidence in the case with the MVAC. The findings were astonishing.
When they said there was a large amount of male DNA, my jaw dropped. Brian and I were just ecstatic. It was like Christmas 10 times over.
After decades without physical evidence, police now had a DNA profile they could link to the killer. The final step required a sample of DNA from Edward's family members for comparison.
We got DNA by consent from a brother and confirmed a familial match was Edward's.
After years of work, the most puzzling murder of many different investigators' careers was finally solved. thanks to an amateur sleuth, modern science, and good old-fashioned police work. Special Agent Jonathan Grusing.
I thought it was fantastic. The pieces fit. It's a cool story.
Sergeant Ryan Van Fleet.
I'm very proud to have been a part of it. It was really, really gratifying.
Solving the murder is an honor to all of the individuals who had been involved in the case over the years. Agent John Kaiser.
I've lived with it every day. I felt that someday we will figure out a way. And of course, what happened is Brian Davis figured out a way.
But for Investigator Davis, one of the hardest parts of the journey was still ahead. Sharing the truth with Lena's loved ones.
It was very emotional, to be honest. I was powerful, and it was like none other I've experienced in my career.
I can't even imagine how that family felt, you know, the searching, the wanting. It was emotional.
They were so thankful for finally having answers.
Painful answers that Lena's loved ones had suspected for so long. And investigators even provided Lena's family with what they believed was the motive for her murder.
I believe she wanted to leave him. He did not want that to happen. And I think that's when he took matters into his own hands and did what he did.
Police theorized that on the morning of April 8th, Geddes ambushed his wife with a pistol as she got dressed. He transported his victim to his chemical plant, where he froze Lena's body and removed her fingertips. He then drove to Utah, where he left her tightly bound inside a sleeping bag, certain he had gotten away with murder. And for the rest of his life, he avoided justice. Detectives are disappointed that Edward Geddes will never be held responsible for what he had done.
I would love the opportunity to put handcuffs on him and see him behind bars, to see him be held accountable for his actions. But I'm a person of faith. Personally, I do feel there was some divine intervention in solving this case.
Investigators believe the MVAC DNA technology that helped them close Lena's cold case will be instrumental in solving other murders as well. Thanks for listening. Please don't forget to follow, rate, and review. And if you want more information on today's case, visit facebook.com/paulazanofficial or just click the link in the episode description. I'm Paula Zahn. Please join us again next Wednesday when we're back on the case, the podcast.